on the turning away from the pale and downtrodden and the words they say which we won't understand. Don't accept that what's happening is just a case of other suffering. Oh, you'll find that you're joining in the turning away. It's a sin that somehow light is changing to shadow and casting a shroud over all we have now.
Every democracy has
on the wings of the night.
Project Next. Uncovering the trends that are shaping our future.
Hello, loves, and thank you so much for being up late here at KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 in Santa Barbara. It was streaming worldwide at kpfk.org. Project Next, always exciting to be here in the late night because, you know, we get to take off the yoke. And be a little bit sovereign and go wherever we need to go to find answers. And the answers that we're going to be looking for here in this first hour is about your health, your wealth, your sustenance, your mighty eternalized structure, of what that means to have an eternal presence, to have some completeness. And we need to go to the doctor of the future for these kind of discussions. And so in this first half of this first hour, Dr. Carolyn Dean, drcarolyndean.com is going to be with us. She's going to be our resident guru in giving us an overall view of health, wealth, and living a full life. And there is no better woman, homo sapien on this planet than Dr. Dean to come in and kind of sweet talk you into being good to yourself and by that, good to others. And after that, we're going to have the commissar here come in, the new leader of the architecture outside your visible structure. Bob Dobbs is back. He is holding a court on a daily basis here, coming into what you might be calling Dobbstown. So we're going to catch up with a man who has come in and I think perplexed so many for so many years. But you do have to come in and check in and see where the new ground is, if it's hidden, if it's exposed, if we know anything really about the mystery body. Just where in the schnee are we? Bob is with us in this first hour. In the second hour, we are looking at a couple of folks that are going to come on down. Hopefully, Dr. Turi is going to be joining us. It is drturi.com. He made a prediction about UFOs actually becoming public, and there it was on CNN a couple of months ago, showing an amateur photographer getting a shot of this kind of tubular structure that was flashing in the sky and was right there on CNN, that they were actually embracing an unidentified flying object. So really amazing stuff. Going to get with Dr. Turi, see what's coming up for 2012 and 2013, all that goodness here on Project Next. Without further ado, let me welcome our first hour's guest, Dr. Carolyn Dean. Her website is drcarolyndean.com. Man, is she a busy woman. There are a lot of people looking for something other than just health. They're looking for something that makes them complete. And that is something that we have approached and talked about in some of our previous discussions, Dr. Dean. The idea of completeness. Welcome to KPFK once again. Always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Evan. Great to be with you. Well, here's what I'd like to ask you, Evan. Maybe your listeners don't know, but we hung out together in San Diego recently in September at a conference. We even had a little sleepover, and I want you to tell me what you thought about how busy I am and how frantic and how crazy my life is and how horrible it is. Tell folks about how I relate to the world and my completeness. Tell them.
Well, you know what? If there is such a thing as the eye of the storm, then that's what you represent, because around you is a whirlwind of activity, some of it sitting there and taking what is created and destroying it to be create something new. And in the midst of that is your calmness that I witnessed. Here you were in the midst of individuals that would sit there and give you a little bit of attitude about some of your new discoveries. And did that throw you off your game? Did it throw you off your centeredness? No, it did not. And also people that you have inspired to do a more holistic work, etc. We met with one of your candidates of completeness who was coming on board, a wonderful doctor friend of yours. She certainly had a lot and a lot to say about how she progressed and some of the work that she's been doing. And in the midst of all of that, you were just silent and strong. And so I see that there is this very interesting counterpoint that you inhabit, that you stay within. And I'm sure that's why you get so many people coming to you, because they want a piece of what it is you do, a piece of what it is you know, so that they can be also the eye of the storm when it comes to their little microcosms of the planet that they inhabit.
Very good. Very
that was
nice,
that
Evan.
Was my that was my read of it. Was that in close to what you actually facilitate and inhabitate in?
Yes, I'd say that's pretty good assessment analysis. I do feel like that. I feel just there's so much going on in the world and around people around me. I mean, I was there, as you say, with people who wanted to know more about what I'm doing. So it became a dialogue, you know, a Q&A. There were people who were kind of in awe of what I've done and, you know, were trying to be groupies and I wouldn't let them. There are people who I've inspired, you know, decades ago who came back for more. So they're all layers. And this was in the midst of a conference where I was giving it wasn't a keynote, but it was a talk about irritable bowel syndrome and candidiasis. And in the middle of that, I didn't bring you in for that lecture, Evan, but a gastroenterologist, you know, a specialist on the bowel, said, well, there's no proof that candida exists. There's no scientific proof. You know, and he said, I have people coming to see me and they think they have yeast and it, you know, it doesn't prove out to be true. And I said, well, and from the podium, I'm having this discussion. I said, well, how many of those people, usually women, do you see when they come to you and say, I've got all these symptoms. I think I have yeast overgrowth. I think all the antibiotics I took through my life have killed off my good bacteria and my yeast is overgrown and I have all these symptoms. If you sit before them and say, well, I don't believe yeast exists. Your other doctors were wrong. And, you know, none of this is true. It's all in your head. How many of them are going to come back to you or try to work with you and you work with them to try to prove this? I said, science does not have a dietary answer for the overgrowth of candidiasis. Science and medicine just have drug answers. And at this point, it's not really an amenable condition, amenable to drugs. You have to have the diet to treat an overgrowth of candidiasis. You have to have some natural antifungals. You have to have a probiotic. And when doctors haven't been trained in all those things, then they just say, well, it doesn't exist. And then patients just walk away. I mean, they can see the look in a doctor's face when the doctor says, oh, you think you have an overgrowth of yeast, or or if the patient makes the mistake of saying they have systemic yeast, well, that word in medicine just means that there's yeast growing in the blood, and every doctor knows, oh, as soon as you have yeast growing in the blood, you know, you're in the hospital, you're probably dying. So just by the wrong choice of words, these people get impaled, you know, on the sword of allopathic medicine. So it was an interesting conference because there were allopathic doctors there and some alternative doctors. I actually renewed my friendship and acquaintance with the Dr. Linda Isaacs, who works with Dr. Nick Gonzalez in New York. And Nick has recently written a book about his experience with the NIH and how they gave him some piddly sum of money to study his method of treating pancreatic cancer. And I'm just looking for the name of the book right now, because his experience was just nothing short of horrendous.
Wow.
He just, in the book, in the introduction for the book, I think I wrote a bit of a, yes, I wrote something for Natural News on it. And not so much a book review, but just sort of expressing how Nick found that there are no friends in the government when it comes to treating cancer naturally.
Oh yes, I could imagine. I mean, I wondered, what was he thinking going to them, or were they just looking for the information so that they can shoot it down, or that they can take it and use it for themselves and deep six it? Was it wise of him to use his energy and efforts working for such a monstrosity?
Well, I think he hoped. He still had hope. And hope is a big word. I think we've talked about it before on your show, that allopathic medicine is kind of the death of hope for a lot of people. But I think he still had some hope that the Office of Alternative Medicine was in on it, as well as the NIH. And I guess he just hoped that things could be different this this one last time he had a chance. But it's pretty clear that the only way people are going to stay healthy if they take responsibility for their own health. There's no other answer. There's just no other way to express what's going on in allopathic medicine. I see it all the time. I do telephone consults with people, and just call them wellness consults. You know, people approach me and tell me their story, and I just give them experiences of mine and tell them what to do to fine-tune their health. And it's stories like someone who's been on 80 antibiotics in the past 15, 20 years.
Yes, yes.
You know, someone who's had a certain condition, they're given antibiotics, and you'd think after 2-3 times the doctor would say, well, gee, that's not working. Maybe I should try something else. No.
Right.
80 times they do the same treatment. So there's just a horrible disconnection between allopathic medicine and natural medicine. It's because doctors have not learned anything in their medical career about nutrition or natural therapies. I mean, even to the point of something as basic as magnesium.
Yes.
If they kept their eyes open during medical school in biochemistry, I mean, I had 200 hours of biochemistry, and in biochemistry you saw it all. You saw all these metabolic processes, and for every cycle in the body, it required cofactors, which were vitamins and minerals. And you get something like ATP, adenosine triphosphate. It's the main source of energy in cells, and it must be bound to magnesium in order to be biologically active. I mean, that's all there is to it. But it's as if doctors haven't got a clue about that. Someone comes in and, oh, I'm fatigued. I'm fatigued, my muscles twitch, I get leg cramps and Charlie horses, I can't sleep, I'm constipated. These are all magnesium deficiency symptoms. I mean, there's no question. And heart arrhythmias or palpitations. And instead of saying, well, take some magnesium, that should help, they're told, well, you probably need an antidepressant and an anti-anxiety drug. So
right.
That's it.
Yes.
And actually what maybe has happened since even we were last together in September is a very conservative medical body actually gave me an award. It was called the Outstanding Medical Contribution to Cardiac Rhythm Management.
That's pretty huge, cardiac rhythm management.
Yeah. It's an organization with 45 professional staff members. It's in the UK, but it's international. It's called the Heart Rhythm Association, but they have an annual Heart Rhythm Congress. People can just type in Heart Rhythm Congress 2012, and under the awards banner is winners, and there I am. I could not go to Birmingham, England to pick up my award. I might have told you this, because it was when I was in San Diego with you a week or so later I got the award. And they somehow are starting to recognize that, hey, magnesium might be important for the management of arrhythmia. And I'll tell you, I've had so many emails over the years, and more since this award, from people saying, yes, as soon as I found out about magnesium, within a couple of days, even with overnight, my heart arrhythmia stopped, or
what?
My palpitations stopped. And these are, they're not life-threatening, most of the, what they call the benign ones. What they are is just life-destroying, because you're sitting there and your heart's jumping and you get panic attacks.
Yes.
Now, panic attacks are part of magnesium deficiency anyway, but the fact that your heart's jumping around and the doctors keep saying, well, you know, it's normal, we did all these tests and everything's fine, but you know it's not fine because your heart's jumping around. So putting people on some magnesium, you know, any form, like some people just have to take an Epsom salts bath every couple of days, and some people take oral pills or powders, or there are liquids now, the liquid ones, the Angstrom or the Pico Ionic magnesium will be absorbed directly into the cells, and that has an effect to just enhance the thousands of metabolic functions in the body. I used to say that only 325 enzyme systems were affected by magnesium, but now we know it's closer to 1,300.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that simple insight is a revolution. And finally, somebody in the UK has come out and said, well, you know what? Maybe it could be something as simple as getting this key mineral that Dr.
Mm-hmm.
Dean has been putting out there. So overall, what are people doing to their bodies by not recognizing the idea of nutrition? Are we basically just starving ourselves to death? What is happening to our bodies in lieu of doing the right thing?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, Evan, because it's like we're starving for our nutrients and we know something is missing, so we keep eating and eating and eating. You know, we have sort of a hunger. We know we're missing something. So we're eating a lot of empty calories and empty food, so we're gaining weight, but we're starving nutritionally. And that it starts from the soil being totally overworked, and the fertilizers that we use do not replace minerals. I mean, we have to go to a form called remineralize.org, and the remineralized people talk about putting crushed stone and rock into the soil to give the minerals we need. See, what used to happen in the days of the spring floods and the floodplains and everything is the The water from the mountains it would be under snow and ice, and that would melt, and then it would the ice would sort of crush the stones. The water would erode stone and bring silt, S-I-L-T, down to the valleys and the floodplains, and that would nourish the earth. And now what we do is we block the floodplains because people want to live there or, you know, grow their food there without any flooding occurring. And the replacement fertilizers are usually just a nitrogen base, some potassium and phosphorus. And it makes the plants look a bit green, but that's about all. They carry hardly any mineral nutrition.
Well, you know what? That is a brilliant thing. And that is the amazing thing about folks such as yourself and everybody else that is looking to solutions that maybe it can be just that easy as understanding how nature works, crushing up some rocks, you know, having them get together with the soil. Boom. That can be it. Looking to your magnesium, making sure to go to drcarolindean.com because she has written a number of books. Of course, the one that really startled a lot of folks was Death by Modern Medicine. Incredible. And of course, there's the magnesium miracle. So many things that you will find at drcarolindean.com. When we get back, want to ask you about acute and chronic conditions, maybe even in particular about diabetes, because I know there are a lot of folks that have been diagnosed with that right off the bat, and they feel that there is nothing homeopathic remedies can do because it's too late and their doctor scares them into that. So that's what I want to ask you right after this quick break. Dr. Dean is standing by. Darlings, all right, stay tuned. Project Next.
Toward the refinement of humankind.
Initiating Activism 4.0. Your portal will be found at projectnext.us. That's www.projectnext.us. And that us, Darlene, is all of you out there on that lovely World Wide Web. The site is up, which is really great fun. We have a little poll question. I really want to know if you guys do believe that global warming is human-induced. Want to know where you stand on that. Go to projectnext.us on the lines. Dr. Carolyn Dean, drcarolindean.com. We're just jumping back into that because she's only going to be with us for around, 8 more minutes. Boy, time is just zooming by. So, Dr. Dean, had a friend come in and call, kind of, you know, panicked, et cetera, because she's been diagnosed type 2 diabetes, et cetera. And of course, at this point, she doesn't think or it's been said to her that nutrition and that kind of thing is not going to stem the tide enough. What about acute chronic conditions such as diabetes, even cancer? A lot of folks will not go to homeopathic strategies because they think it is too late. Is it too late for chronic and acute conditions?
Not one iota of heaven. And with diabetes, what doctors aren't telling you, and it's right in their books, that a magnesium deficiency is one of the signs of diabetes. I've had people tell me when they start taking their magnesium, their blood sugar balance is out. And actually, just a few minutes ago, before I knew that you were going to ask this question, a friend of mine, Dr. Roby Mitchell, and he's at drfitt.com, drfit.com. Roby sends out emails to a bunch of doctor friends, and he says, "We know now that type 2 diabetes is not a disease because it evaporates after gastric bypass surgery along with the rest of the so-called metabolic syndrome. This happens before significant weight loss. This is a type of epidemiology by observation that shows that type 2 diabetes increases in second-generation immigrants of people who grew up not eating the high-sugar, high-grain Western diet. Type 2 diabetes is reversible with diet changes alone. So if people gave up their sugar and gave up their bread, you know, gave up sugar, wheat, and dairy are the three big things, took their magnesium, their blood sugars would go back to normal. But somehow doctors don't believe in diet. They've never been trained in diet, so they don't believe in anything that they weren't trained in medical school. They have this total bias, and they've been told. I mean, I went to medical school, and I was told the same thing. If you haven't learned it in medical school, it's quackery or it doesn't exist.
And what about cancer?
Cancer, I give you a whole hour on total biology, how cancer is the result of a conflict, major contrast and conflict in your life where your brain can't deal with the stress and the conflict and puts a physical disease into your body as a way to find a solution for that severe stress.
Right. And so how is that treated? If somebody has a chronic, you know, well, I guess cancer, once it's diagnosed, becomes chronic at that time, can that be reversed, or do people always have to go to chemo to stabilize, or is there a way to attack it without that radiation hitting you?
Well, it's not even attacking it, because it's not attacking you. If you heard what I said,
yeah,
it's the body's solution. It's not a bad thing until allopathically we say, oh, this is going to kill you, and then there's your diagnosis of being dead.
Yes.
So that's your second major stress in 1 minute.
Yes.
And what you get when you look at it in a total biology way is, you know, I'm a mother, say, and my child is in a car accident, unconscious in the emergency, and I'm freaking out. And that goes on for weeks at a time, still unconscious. So what happens, in order to save my sanity, my mind puts some of that stress into my breast and creates excess breast tissue to try to produce milk to nurture my child.
Mm.
It's a very primitive reaction.
Mm.
And then when the stress starts to release and then the breast tissue starts to break down, that's when we diagnose breast cancer. Because anything that doesn't look normal to medicine is abnormal and probably cancer. So it's a reaction, and if people understand that, if they say, oh, yeah, I was in this major stress, oh, okay, that could be it, and they can actually resolve it with knowledge.
Yes, and the knowledge that it starts internally, it started internally with stress and thought and,
mm-hmm,
you know, anxiety, and that's where it has to start its healing process, is
very
in that
good.
Very same, right?
Exactly.
It has
very
to
good.
Go right down into that subconscious level. That's really incredible stuff, because, of course, as soon as somebody is diagnosed, boy, the medical apparatus goes crazy. It's like, cool, okay, here we got all these tests, we got all
mm-hmm.
these biopsies, we get to smash you into this mammogram machine,
mm-hmm.
you know, a few more times. It seems like it really lives a great deal off of the cascading environment that happens once you get diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And then
that fear gives you it can actually stimulate another cancer, the fear of dying.
Yes.
You know, that's where you get your metastasis. The fear of dying goes to the lung. And everybody's, oh, yeah, that cancer usually goes to the lungs. It's like they just plot it out. It's horrible.
Well, you know what? I think that you're hitting on the main point, and you said it earlier in the interview. It's that there is a lot of self-realization that people have to do for their responsibility for their health.
Mm-hmm.
And not that, I guess there are such things as psychosomatic illnesses.
Yes, I mean, you take someone who says, oh, he's such a pain in the neck, and there they are holding their neck, and they constantly have a headache and neck pain. Well, yeah, you know, if you hang out with someone who's a pain in the neck, then you're going to feel it there. Or if it's something, oh, that I just can't stomach what he says, and they're suffering with stomach ulcers. I mean, come on, this is stuff that someone a little distant from you, a little bit detached, can obviously see, but somehow we're blinded to the obvious things in our life because, I mean, we hate change. Humans hate change. So we'd rather put up with something frustrating and painful than think we have to do something different and be afraid of change.
So what percentage of the medical community is with you on understanding the idea of thoughts, emotions, et cetera, and sickness, and also going non-intrusive surgeries and anti-drugs? How many folks out there like you are there?
Oh, very few. I mean, for example, I'll speak at some of these medical conferences, and there'll be 100 people there who are sort of naturopathic and natural medicine, whereas a cancer oncologist specialist conference will have 8,000, 10,000 doctors.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, huge disparity.
So hold it. Are they breaking some kind of oath? Is there something they need to be held to? And this is a final question. We're almost out of time. But what are they doing? Aren't they violating some principle?
You mean the first do no harm? Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
First do no harm. I mean, think about it. Think about chemo. And there was it in just who? New England Journal of Medicine or something. There was just a research study that said, hey, by the way, chemotherapy isn't working, and most people think it does.
Right.
It's like, you know, 70-80% of people think when in their advanced cancer stage, it's when they take chemotherapy, that it actually could save them. And the doctors, like maybe 5% of them, believe that that's the case. So why do they keep doing it?
Right. Incredible stuff, Dr. Dean. Well, look, this has been just a real quick hit with you, but we are going to have you back for that full hour to talk about cancer, because that, in a sense, really is kind of the basis to the approach of your completeness, being the doctor of the future for people to take responsibility. And that starts with your thoughts, your actions, and being kind to yourself and kind to others. And so congratulations on your award. That is brilliant. I hope it has... I hope it brings just so many more people into your fold. So I appreciate you, and thank you so much for this quick time with you today.
Oh, thank you, Evan. I appreciate you, too. Big hug.
Absolutely. Fantastic. DrCarolynDean.com. Go there, darlings. Magnesium. Amazing stuff. All right. Standing in the wings, Bob is going to be joining us here, and that is always exciting. So hold on to your skull caps, and we'll be right back. Project Next.
Purifying the humankind.
On the lines, I do hope, is our lovely second half of the first half of this hour's guest, Bob. Are you there, sir?
Yes, Evan. Thanks for having me back again.
Oh, my gosh. It has been too long, and that's just because, I don't know, it just seems that everything is speeding up, Bob. And so when you were last on, you made a pronouncement that you will be holding court on a daily basis, weekly basis, and letting people understand the new environment that we're in. Please give us an update as to what is going on in the world.
Well, the... there's obviously not anything relevant going on in the presidential election, so I decided to declare myself the occupant of the White House. It's a vacant situation. So on August 22nd, I became president of the United States and any other larger regions that you want to include within the empire of the United States. And so starting on August 22nd, I had a free teleconferencing with anybody who could call in. So people called in. Usually people associate it with the ion phenomenon because they're aware of me right now. I'm more active in that area.
Yes.
So the reason I declared myself president is that I have the authority of knowledge and the authority of the new environment. I have RNA drops and I have cold fusion technology I'm bringing forth. So these two aspects put me outside and above and below and beside and around and in a new zone. And with that new level of experience, I've got the authority, and therefore I put on the robe of power.
Yes.
So I did that from August 22nd until October 22nd, 2 months, every day. I was on there 3, 4, 5 hours taking calls from people or talking about anything. It was a model of how I'd be president. The president doesn't have to do any legislation. The president doesn't have to do anything. He just sits there and responds to the issues and gives his interpretation of events and sees if he can... push a new level of perception going on.
Well,
the whole thing is not to change the world. The president's not there to change the world. He's there to take an oath and defend the country. So I thought that with RNA drops and cold fusion, I think that would defend the country.
What were people's main concerns, Bob?
Whether I'm real or not.
Okay.
who am I? How can I be 90 years old? The usual gossip level. Humans don't seem to believe what I'm offering. Now, you know, on the RNADrops.com, we get incredible testimonials. The cold fusion has not provided a battery for you or anybody else yet, but there is good reasons why that's going to be brought forward in a different, more stealth manner, because that's the most upsetting thing you can do, is knock out the old consciousness. So the questions dialogue was really good. There was always something interesting said every day, and it gave me the opportunity to say different patterns of perception about it, whatever was said. Plus, I learned from the people called in, whatever they had to do. So I did this for 2 months, and I found that most people got into a passive mode of just listening. And I'm there to help people learn how to speak.
Yes.
And use the power of their language and their words.
Yes.
So after 2 months, I decided to take about 22 people and name them members of my cabinet, and we're now doing more or less closed sessions. Not every day of the week. We do it 3 times a week. So it was a public, basically, you know how the media gives the president, whoever's going to win this election, we'll get, if the new guy wins, if Romney wins, he'll get 100 days of honeymoon in January to May or something. You know about that? The media lets them get their grounding and their feet, supposedly. And then they turn on them, and then you start doing and applying to the president what this economy's run on, which is abuse value, not surplus value, labor value, exchange value, but abuse value. So the media goes after him. So I decided that after almost 100 days of my honeymoon period with the media press, I called anybody who came. I would demand them to represent some media outlet. So after 2 months, I said, well, the honeymoon's over, and I'm going to abuse everybody. So I started abusing the media by first going in camera. You know, that means going into secret cabinet meetings, just like any president does. So we'll come out every now and then. This is a good opportunity to come out. I'll come out and speak about what we're doing. But I'm on an obvious level being a typical president, but secretly not. So I want to give you a few insights that have happened since my administration took over on August 22nd. Researchers discovered that James Joyce modeled his book, Finnegan's Wake, on a character commonly known as Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker. And the initials are HCE, which stands for Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, or Here Comes Everybody. And the story is about how HCE merges into the tribal Finn, the Finn cycle, or Finnegan, the tribal Finn, as an awake phenomenon under electric conditions. Well, in this book called How Joyce Wrote Finnegan's Wake, a chapter-by-chapter genetic guide by Luca Crispi and Sam Sloat, they're the editors. Now, what it means to be a genetic guide in literary criticism is a new kind of criticism where they go and look at the manuscripts and the papers and all the notes and that before the novel was published.
Yes.
They get into it. Well, with James Joyce, there's 25,000 pages of notes for Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, my
so
God.
So all these scholars have been, you know, crawling through it. And a couple of new unknown manuscripts showed up in 2006. So a lot of new knowledge. So I recommend this book. It really is a key to how to understand what Joyce is doing with Finnegan's Wake and how he became a model of our paramodern media processing world, information processing world, Android processing world that you and I and everybody is forced to be. He started it in the 20s and 30s. Okay, so in this book, they found a note from 1909, very early in his career. He'd been reading this cartoon called Pop in some newspaper called The Daily Sketch, some European papers. I don't know where it is, maybe it's Ireland, England. And in the Daily Sketch, this character Pop, this patriarchal character, this cartoon character, James Joyce modeled Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker on this Pop. Now, the name the Pop had, this Pop, was, or the name that Joyce gave it, is J.R. Dodd. D-O-D-D. Does that sound close to
something? Wow.
Okay?
Okay.
J.R. Dodd, D-O-D-D. Now, I'm Bob Dobbs, and many people mistake me for the Church of Subgenius, which has the cartoon character J.R. Bob Dobbs.
Right.
So here you have James Joyce, and I've always said Fitting's Wake was about me and Carolyn, mm-hmm. But here's this actual using very close to my name. Now, the day I discovered this a couple of weeks ago, I was looking through page 191 of Fitting's Wake. I had a reason to go there, and there it says in the middle of the page, he bings his scooter along, and then they were real brothers in the big Just Right home where Dodd lives. Now, the big Just Right home where Dodd lives, page 191 of Fitting's Wake, well, I was coming home from the beach that day, and I was telling Carol about how fantastic the position of our home is. It's like just right. It's just incredibly just right. And I'm just celebrating that, its view over Maui Bay and all that. And I get home, and I start reading this book, and I find this thing later in the day where it says J.R. Dodd is the character model that Joyce is modeling the book on. And then I look up Dodd because I knew it was in the book. It's on page 27, and it says they were all real brothers in the big just right home where Dodd lives. The very words I was saying earlier in the day shows up right beside Dodd. Anyways, this is what happens when you're president. Things get real tight.
On the lines. President Bob Dobbs.
That's right,
from
President Bob Dobbs.
Yes, and from his home. Hold on, we're just taking a quick break. I have to stay on this clock thing, dagnabbit. Sorry, Prez. And so we are catching up on our shadow government, on our cosmic government, on our stratospheric ionic government. I don't know.
Mythic government.
Okay, there it is, on our mythic government. And by the myth buster, myth maker, President Bob Dobbs here on Project Next, darlings. I know. Just hold on. He'll be back. And we hope you will, too. All right. Stay tuned. Project Next.
Elixir for the human mind.
You know the problem. Now, what are you going to do about it? Stand by to converge at projectnext.us. That's www.projectnext.us. And that us is growing bigger and bigger every day. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Streaming worldwide at kpfk.org, also projectnext.us, kpfk.org. It is a big, lovely family. And the great thing is being up so late, you get to hear some very forward-moving information. And that is coming out of headquarters, Hawaii side, here with President Bob Dobbs and our mythic government. You know, and I certainly will subscribe, and so I hope you will too. And so before this very quick break, we were catching up on some of the other discoveries from our leader, Bob. Hi, Bob.
Yes, a follower. Now, when I'm talking about mythic government, that's a structure around you in the Android meme. I'm actually an anthropomorphic physical government. But mythic government is what you're witnessing today. That's another term for that is virtual reality. Myth doesn't mean false or untrue. It just means comprehensively extraordinary. That's what a myth is.
Absolutely.
And condensed. Okay, just also on page 191, here's a few lines before they described Mr. Dodd. It says, all true of other times, he who was well known to Celestine circles before he sped aloft, our handsome young spiritual physician that was to be, seducing every sense to self-willing celibacy, the most winning counterfoil on out our income share lottery, a chum of the angelets, a youth those reporters so pettily wanted as game fellow, blah, blah, blah. Now, the point is that I've always thought of that section, the handsome young spiritual physician, that's what I've been for decades. I mean, I'll even claim that I know more about real medicine than Carolyn, all right, than Dr. Dean. But that has to remain to be understood. So the point is, but this page 197 describes me to the T and has my name almost there, Mr. Dodd. That was the first discovery. The second discovery is that, you know, the James Bond movies, you ever seen any of those?
All of them.
Okay.
Practical.
Well, I never saw any. Maybe one 40 years ago or something, but never thought they were too significant. So I decided over the last few weeks in my, you know, commanding situation, commandant, I decided to look at all the James Bond movies. So I've been going through them. You can get them real easily on letmewatchthis.com or watchseries.eu. Everything is there. That's what SOPA is trying to stop. The Chinese government is just hijacking Netflix and giving us all these television shows and everything for free. Every movie, everything ever happened. You aware of that?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's all there available. So I'm going through all the James Bond movies. I've done about 15. And it struck me, it's quite blatant. It is the most intelligent political manifesto going that everybody should have understood in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I'm not talking about the drama or the excitement or the saving of people or the sexism or the misogyny and all this content stuff. What it is, it's showing actually what the mythic government was. It was a solar government operating from space, and every James Bond movie is about some crisis in the solar government structure. Mm-hmm. Somebody is attempting to hijack the planet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a communist or a right-winger, a neocon, or a left-winger.
It's a syndicate. It's somebody with the resources and too much time on their hands.
That's right. A billionaire. Some kind of billionaire, and a Rumpelstiltskin who attempts to hijack the whole environment, which he can do. And on that level, James Bond, he can't follow any rules. He can't have any morals. He can't even do anything. These are serious crises, and he's got to kill the guy, you know, no matter what. So the whole thing that I've been telling people about for 30 years, about the solar government, is laid out in this pop culture phenomenon, James Bond.
Yeah.
Even McLuhan once said that it's a CIA world. It's a James Bond world. If you think of the CIA as a domestic operation or international operation, the extension of the world government, you got it wrong. No. It's not a CIA operation. It's a solar government operation. It's a solar government world. And the James Bond movies point that out. So I recommend looking at them from that point. And a lot of what Ian Fleming wrote about in the 50s is pretty prophetic, and a lot of the stuff Dr. Beter went on to point out actually happened, like the very scenario of Dr. No, you know, radiating the Fort Knox gold so that only his gold would be left to focus the economy around. That is actually what Dr. Beter said happened to Fort Knox. So people can look up Dr. Beter and see that either he stole scenarios from James Bond or Ian Fleming knew what was up.
Just to jump in real quick, Skyfall is coming up November 9th, and that is a scenario where one of James Bond's cohorts within MI6 turns against MI6. And
well, there
so
you
he's,
go.
He's
that's
an inside.
A common scene today.
Yeah.
Somebody goes postal.
Postal with a vengeance and the knowledge.
With the resources.
Yeah, and the resources.
Okay, now, so we move along here. The other thing is, what was my part in Hurricane Sandy? Well, if you read my diaries, you'll see that there was a man in Halifax, Dartmouth, Nova Scotia named Hugh Boyd. And there's a couple of diary entries of me interacting with Hugh, and I offer him a job on the Bounty. I say I have a way of getting him into the Marlon Brando 1962 movie Mutiny on the Bounty. You can read these in the diaries. Anybody want to know about the diaries, you can ask you or email me. Mm-hmm. The point is, there's Hugh Boyd. He gets a gig on the Bounty in 1962, and therefore he's in the movie, Mutiny on the Bounty. And for the locals in Nova Scotia and Canada, that was a big deal. This local guy, he was a swashbuckling guy, young guy, Hugh Boyd. Well, when Hurricane Sandy happened a few days ago, one of the casualties is that boat known as the Bounty. It sank. The present captain of the Bounty tried to skirt the storm, you know, from North Carolina to Florida or something.
Right,
and got caught and sank. And they saved 90% of the crew, but they lost the captain and maybe one other person. I don't know if they found the captain yet. And other people saying, why did this captain take the risk? So they went and talked to the old captain, you know, a few years ago, 5 years ago, and that was Hugh Boyd. And Hugh Boyd is at the center of the news story around this boat, the Bounty, because it was used in the Pirates, Johnny Depp movie.
Right.
Pirates of the Caribbean or something.
Right.
Yeah, it's been used in many movies. It's a very, well-made, neat, old-fashioned ship, and like a tall ship, they might call it. And I was part of that, 50 years ago, in getting Hugh Boyd on the boat, and then 50 years later, he's at the center of attention because he was remembering his days on the boat and very upset they got sunk and wondering why the captain did that. So there again, through coincidence and media's anachrony, I'm right in the center of everything again. I didn't ask for this.
So what is happening? Why did Sandy arrive? I understand that the ocean temperatures were in the 50s. It usually ocean temperatures have to be in the 70s for something that huge to be generated. Was that an artificially created hurricane?
No, it was an accident. In our work with the cold fusion, we stir up a lot of the forces on the planet, and we have a bit of a problem sometimes, and it's just collateral damage. It's just part of you guys. You require cold fusion. Well, we got to go make these moves to bring it in, and sometimes, and you remember the earthquake last August? That was another little glitch that came out of our operation, so don't worry about it. Everybody needs a media fast anyways. It's good to have no electricity for a week or two. That, it makes you get a perspective on your four bodies.
Well, that's for them. But the rest of the country is pretty fine. And
yeah.
So what other cascading events happen around the development of cold fusion, and why is it dealing with the energy systems of this planet? Isn't it something from outside our dimensions that would come in?
It does involve the non-physical.
Right.
State that way. And that involves all kinds of dimensions. Yes. Look at Fringe. Fringe is actually a TV show. It's pretty accurate about what we're doing, and it's not an accident that the guy, Walter, looks like me.
Yeah, no kidding.
And all these other synchronicities with me. I mean, Fringe is a direct ripoff of what we're doing here at Iandum in Dobbstown. Now, what have we got, 10 minutes left?
Around. Okay. Well, no more like 8.
Okay, well, there's a lot more I could say about that, but I don't want to dwell on it too much. You know, it couldn't have happened to a better city, New York City. It's great, you know.
Okay.
Great that.
Well, it happened to Jersey. It really nailed Jersey.
Jersey, sure. You put on bad TV shows, you're going to get the karma.
Okay, what is. I heard that there is a $42 trillion lawsuit going against the banks, some of the higher muckety mucks, the gazillionaires, and all this kind of stuff. Is that true, Bob?
No. First of all, there's no money in the world. I mean, I go over this all the time.
Yeah.
Because money is not constituent anymore, it's a digital economy, and that collapsed a few years ago.
Right.
That is why there is abundant cash in the world. We've had abundant cash over the last 30 years because it's obsolete. It's not constituented. What is constituent, what holds people together, is typing and information and the digital world.
Right.
But there's so much cash running around over the last 30 years that everybody was having a good time. But when the digital ground for that collapsed a couple of years ago in 2008, then the cash appears to have disappeared. It doesn't disappear because people can keep typing and claiming that they're doing bailouts and keep the myth going. The myth, the actual virtual reality.
But if it is that the cash has disappeared and it is all digital entries, well, those digital entries add up to around, what do they call, $600 trillion in derivatives? Those are the digital entries. Those are the little pluses and minuses that are flying on everybody's books around. And that still trickles down and has a...
None of that's true. Now, here's how, since we only got six minutes left, let me explain this.
Okay.
There's a new book by Ted Hebert, H-I-E-B-E-R-T, called In Praise of Nonsense, subtitled Aesthetics, Uncertainty, and Postmodern Identity, comes out of the McGill Queen's University Press in Montreal.
Okay.
So, there's a review by David Cacchetto, and I'm going to, who's an artist and teacher up in Toronto, I'm going to read a few excerpts to give you a clue on some of the ideas here.
Okay.
All right. So you have the death of truth. That's a common postmodern academic statement. This kids go to school and find out that truth has died, okay?
Hmm.
Well, that means also, complementarily, there's a death of falsity.
Hmm.
Okay? They go together, truth and false. So reading this, Mr. Hebert asks these questions in this way. He asks them in the context of the death of falsity that accompanies postmodernism's death of truth. It seeks to replace the horizon of truth with a horizon of imaginative possibility. That's sort of like myth.
Right.
In other words, you are now free to imaginate your economy. Such is precisely the impulse behind this book by Ted V. Hebert. It's a vertigo-inducing meditation on nonsense as a live vector of quotidian postmodernism. Hebert's pursuit of this horizon, executed through encounters with philosophers, artists, and technologists alike, moves always in two directions simultaneously. He follows Wittgenstein in the critical enterprise of demonstrating that, quote, behind every well-founded belief lies belief that is not founded. And this, Hebert contributes to an ever-proliferating body of literature found across disciplines that deals with the performativity of knowledge. For Hebert and for Eben, knowledge is not so much a revelation of what is objectively true, but is instead an iterative, dispersed, and ongoing activity of maintaining the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that knowledge is a way of maintaining the status quo, and this is what you have to deal with every day.
Mm-hmm.
In your show.
Mm-hmm.
So the task of the critic then, or the task of Eben then, becomes one of identifying the particular contingencies of a situation that allow it to adopt the appearance of truth as well as the excluded inclusions that persistently trouble the boundaries of such appearances of truth.
Mm-hmm.
In order to engage this lived aesthetic, Hebert argues that the postmodern self is technologized along a combination of three factors. The first of these are technology of disappearance. You know, I've been telling you since 2000 about it. I mean, it's disappeared.
Right.
All right?
Right, right.
So you have the technologies of disappearance, and included in this category are the technologies of reflection, perception, and autopoiesis, all of which are implicated in subject formation. That means per-person formation, and each of which occasion engagement by Hebert with prominent theorists. Crucially, Hebert's understanding of disappearance in general recalls McLuhan's notion of obsolescence. And they sum up that, just as an obsolete technology doesn't cease to exist but rather persists in new forms, think of money, and hence obsolescence is the beginning of aesthetics, the cradle of taste, of art, of eloquence, and of slang. The disappearance of knowledge is not an absence but a mode of living, a lived disappearance. That's the way you live, Eben, where we all live. Thus, what remains when knowledge disappears is an experience without knowledge, nevertheless, takes form, paradoxical though that might be. So, Hebert nominates the term technologies of ironic appearance. Now, in my manifesto, Up the Orphandi, in 1995, I talked about me and Carolyn being the first to appear. So they're finally catching up here. They are advocating technologies of ironic appearance as a means of characterizing the myriad modes of prioritizing the masquerade of falsity over the domination of truth, demonstrating the numerous ways in which the performance of disappearance always contains a trace of irony, a self-reflexive relationship to the paradox of its own impossibility. So, the house that Hebert builds, an architecture that is all the more potent for its fragility, for the fact that it is built on illusions, slippery metaphors and rhetorical reversals as much as linear reasoning. And again, Hebert is explicitly engaged in an exercise of thought as incantation. I've been saying for several years now we live at the speed of thought, not the speed of light. So he's engaged in an exercise of thought as incantation in response to a culture of ubiquitous logical indeterminacy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't tell if the information is directed at you or not. When you watch the media, it's a good way to survive is to know that the media is not talking to you.
You can just decide to take it personally or not.
That's right. And either way is a good strategy. Both is false and valuable. It is logical indeterminacy.
So where is your currency, Bob?
RNA drops. As that spreads around the world, that will reap so many billions of bucks. Ion's already saying that they're gathering up the gold to dump at my doorstep. All the old oligarchs are going to try getting good with this new situation, this new environment. Ion's a new environment. Our product, RNA drops, is so incredible. It solves every health problem anybody ever had, plus more. It's better than ayahuasca. It's better than LSD. It's better than milk. It's not as good as Eben. Eben's pretty good, but, as a second, it's not bad. We can build an economy on it. So the point is that we build an economy on our spiritual gifts.
Very good. Very good. Well, wow. And so from there, as a foundation.
What have I got? I got a minute?
Sky is the limit. No, I'm giving you an extra 2 minutes.
Okay, good. Because I want to, and I know it's a bunch of big words, but this is for those to rehear. We put in simple stories about James Bond and Hurricane Sandy. Here's the complex part. You got to have both. Let's be comprehensive. So, in conclusion, Hebert's argument then, the final step, this is what his solution is, the final step is to ask after, quote, the possibilities for inauthentic engagement to be non-ironic. To be ironic, you'd be too authentic. But to be inironic or non-ironic is to be inauthentic. And you engage a mode of living with uncertainty that would no longer be simply the attempt to self-contextualize as a function of contingencies of disappearance, but to instead begin remapping uncertainty itself. He calls the various means of achieving this technologies of delirious appearance. The counter of the disappearance, a term that explicitly reverses the terminologies of sensical apparition in favor of the delirious possibilities of livable unreason. Now, that sounds like my presidency.
And that sounds like that people are all going back to school. I mean, really.
No. They are their own teachers now.
Hmm. Okay.
There's no information that you could use that comes from anybody else. You're going to make up your own information. This is called making sense. All of civilization before was matching your sense of reality with someone else to create community.
Yes.
Now the new kind of community is based on logical uncertainty and attempts to improvise your own making sense and see if anybody else actually drums along with you.
Well, I mean, so you're sitting at, how does that affect your, like, out to eat and you're sitting at somebody's dinner table? I mean, there are some common decencies. There are some.
Oh, yeah. They're all, do you ever see, there's, nobody follows decency. They're all looking at their iPhones.
Okay, that's true.
They're not social. They're not polite anymore.
You know, you're absolutely right. Bob, we have to end on that note, and that is a great summation that talks about the disintegration of whatever we think to know about ourselves and about each other. And
yeah.
So I can't wait for the next time. Hopefully we can have it sooner than later, okay?
Okay, Evan, great talking to you.
And you too, Bob.
Talk to you then.
Yes, sir. All right.
Right.
All right, darlings. End of this first raging first hour. How fun is that? Ah. Amazing stuff. Make sure and go to drcarolyndean.com, fivebodied.com, fivebodied.com. So much information out there. All right, stay tuned.